Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Office Deep Dive. I am your host, as always, Brian Baumgartner. So as this podcast begins to take on, well, a new look, to take new wings and launch into version 2.0, which I can't wait to share with you, I have to admit, I've been thinking a lot about how extraordinarily lucky I have been to get to create all of this and to have so many of you respond so well to it. You guys, it means so much to me. So for a special treat, I am compiling the best of the best from the Office Deep Dive into a two-part episode release. I couldn't include everyone, of course, and I truly do love my entire Office family. So go back and listen to any of the episodes you might have missed. But today, we're going to start where it all started. Across the pond, in jolly old England, in the land that made the very dish that inspired our own Creed Bratton to write this podcast theme song, Bubble and Squeak. That is, we are going to begin inside the beautiful mind of Ricky Gervais.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Do you remember the first time you met Ben Silverman?
Yes, I do. I was walking down the street in London. I think I was going to see my agent. And the phone rang, and he said, "Hi, it's Ben Silverman. You don't know me. I wanna remake The Office for America." And I went, "Okay, all right." He said, "Can we meet up?" He said, "I'm in town." I went, "Right." He said, "Where are you? I'll come to you. I'll grab the cab." I went, "Okay." And I looked up and I said, "Right, I'm right outside Starbucks in Wardour Street." And he went, "Wait there. I'll be there in 15 minutes." And he jumped in a cab. I'd never met anyone like him. He came and found me because obviously he knew what I'd look like because he'd watched The Office. And he talked to me and I said, "Well, listen, let me introduce you to my agent to get the ball rolling." And I took him in to see Duncan Hayes, who was my still is my UK agent. And that was the beginning of it. And then I can't remember all the details or all the phone calls, but I think the next big step was we sort of auditioned showrunners. And we saw some amazing ones from my favorite programs of all time. We chose Greg, and I think we chose Greg, not just because of his body of work, which was as good as anyone's, and he was a nice chap, but I think it was because he was the only one that brought up that he thought it was a love story. That was very important to me, the love story.
Right.
So, I didn't want it to, I never thought of it was, you know, just a sitcom. You know, traditionally sitcoms were, as I say, an ordinary guy getting into capers and ending up back at square one. And there wasn't really romance, but, you know, we stole that from America because, and movies, because, you know, there was always a love interest in movies, and a lot of American shows had more romance and love interest than ours. That was usually about a grumpy middle-aged man. So we liked that. And then I can't remember what order this was in, but I think it was the Golden Globes where we won for The Office and I won Best Comedy Actor.
Yes.
I think that was the same week that we went to Ben Silverman's office. And I don't know if it was before and after, but then Ben and Greg came to London. I think that was nearer the time when we were getting very close to actually starting production. And we worked out the translation. What was slough in America? You know, what was the equivalent of this? And what was the equivalent of that? And do we have this? And we almost did like a blueprint to, you know, just Americanizing stuff.
Right.
And then we started auditions, and And that was it. I do remember at one point, I think before auditions or when we were thinking of looking for, you know, the David Brent, and I think Ben Silverman called me and said, why don't you play him? And I said, well, what would be the point of that? I did my
bit.
You did it. Now I want to rest. Now I want some other schmuck to do 200 episodes. but mainly my reason, apart from the fact that I was lazy and I was terrified of working hard for 7 years, I said, no, this should be made by Americans for Americans. And I was flattered that they even let us be as involved as we were. But, you know, it really took off when they started making their own show. You know, the first episode was basically a remake.
Right.
But then it just got further and further away. And, you know, by the end, it was its own show. And I remember that people were scared because The Office was such a media darling, you know, to a few Americans. Even at its peak, I remember The Office in America, our version. I remember it was the biggest show on BBC America, and it had something like 1.1 million viewers. And Ben Silver was saying, listen, there's a lot of people that haven't seen this that won't be prejudiced. But of course, I remember he was worried about the press saying this is a, you know, this we love the original. He came up with a really good thing. When they were saying, why would you do a remake of this? The original was perfect. He said, well, I wouldn't make a film of a shitty novel. I'd make a film of the best novel I could find. And I thought that was such a clever counter. But of course we want a remake of something that's really good. Why would we do a remake of something that was terrible?
That was shitty. Right.
And then soon, you know, people forgot that there was original. Some people don't even know there's an original. To most Americans, that they've no idea that this is a remake, and they don't care. And, you know, and I imagine most people who love The American Office, they prefer it to the British version. So, which is a great position to be in for me. I remember once, it was after syndication, and someone on Twitter sent me a tweet that said, the American version of The Office is so much bigger and better than yours. How does that make you feel? And I sent back, fucking rich.
Well, there are certainly worse things to feel. So Ricky was in England, more than happy to let The Office take off in a brand new direction. Meanwhile, back in the States, some of our cast was still keeping a close eye on Ricky's work. Rainn Wilson, in particular, had his eye on the prize.
Were you aware of the British version of The Office?
I was. So my friend Sam Catlin, he had heard about it and he had seen a couple episodes and somehow gotten some like British DVD or something like that and had like even like an English DVD player or something, somehow had advanced copies and was like, you've got to see it. Groundbreaking, amazing. And so we went over like on a special occasion, like, you've got to watch The Office. And we were blown away. So I was really, truly one of the first people to see it in the United States. It might have been one of the first couple thousand people to see it in the United States. And just we loved it. And then he would get his hands on a couple more episodes and we'd go back and have dinner and watch like two or three more episodes. So I loved it. And what happened was I got cast in a pilot with Janine Garofalo for ABC. Mark Maron was in it and Bob Odenkirk was in it.
Okay.
And this was this infamous pilot that we did the table read and they pulled the plug after the table read. So they had sets built. Wow. We had locations. We had cast. We had plane tickets. We were flying out the next day, literally the next morning after the table read, start shooting. And did the table read. It went terribly. But guess what? I still got paid.
And that was the same pilot season as The Office?
Kind of. The Office didn't really follow a pilot season when it was first casting.
Right.
So what happened was Vernon Sanders, who's one of the
executives on NBC.
Executives, right? And I ran into him in the parking lot on the way to this infamous table read. And he's like, hey, we got good news. And I was like, what's that? He's like, we got the rights to make the American version of The Office. And I was like, outside, I was like, oh, great. And inside, I was like, motherfucker. God damn it. That fucking sucks. Because I loved The British Office so much. I didn't have an idea of like even what The American Office would be or what role I would play or anything like that. But I was just like inside, I was just kicking myself. Oh! And then the plug gets pulled on that. And then I call my people. And I'm like, hey, I hear about this office. And they're like, yeah, well, there's a few months to go on that. So fortunately that the space was opened and the door was open. The universe works in mysterious ways, Brian.
That's right. It does. And so you eventually get a call to go in and meet, correct?
I was the first audition for The Office. I have in my office at home framed the audition sheet of Allison Jones the first day of the auditions for The Office. And I was number one on that list. So other people on the list are Jenna Fisher. You can find it. It's on my Instagram somewhere. It might even be in my book, in the photos included in my book, so you guys can find it. But I think Adam Scott auditioned. I think there were there was a lot of great talent that auditioned.
My story about that, I'll share with you really quick, was when Steve left. Allison Jones came to me. He had a little party, a little reception. She came and she goes, I was looking for stuff for Steve that I thought might be cool. She probably gave that to you, like when she was searching around.
Uh-huh.
And she hands me a sheet and it says, Kevin. And it says, Brian Baumgartner, Eric Stonestreet, and Jorge Garcia.
No kidding.
So that was like the final three. But
oh, fantastic. Yeah. Wow. Wow.
So you...
And although Eric Stonestreet is way richer than you.
He is now. I know.
Yeah, he... Sorry.
Shoot.
Sorry. So, yeah. So on that first audition, I auditioned for both Michael and Dwight, and my Michael was just terrible. It was just simply a Ricky Gervais impersonation, and I knew that I had more of an affinity for the Dwight role, and I knew that I could really deliver on that. I just felt it in my bones. I'm like, oh, this is me. This is exactly my kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, you were so different also than Gareth. In the British version.
Yeah.
I mean, he was much
Mackenzie
more
Crook, yeah.
Weasley and Dwight way more authoritarian and trying to derive power, whereas Gareth seemed more backstabby.
Yeah, we're different in a lot of ways and similar in a lot of ways. And it was this incredible luxury to go, okay, here's Mackenzie Crook, this brilliant actor, really strange looking dude. And he killed as Gareth. And was so interesting. And I get to steal all of his best stuff. And then there's maybe stuff that I can add that's more my own. So it's win-win all around. So one of the things that Dwight is most known for is saying absolutely ludicrous, preposterous stuff with a total straight face and a deadpan without any knowledge that what he's saying is ridiculous. And really, Mackenzie did that so beautifully. And I really just... frankly, stole that from him. Another thing I stole from him was the haircut. I read an interview with him where he said he went to like just a local barber shop out in like Slough or some, you know, suburb of London. And he kind of got the haircut that would be the least flattering for his head and the most ridiculous haircut. And I read that. I was like, oh, I want to do that. So I spent time in the mirror figuring out what's the haircut that is going to make me look the most ridiculous. I have a huge forehead. And I was like, I'm going to frame my forehead perfectly with these little draperies of hair that will highlight the enormity of my carapace. Is that a word? I think it is a word.
I think it's a word.
These guys aren't even listening.
No.
And then like really short on the sides and then and intense. And then it evolved over time.
Yes. The Office did have some pretty bad haircuts. Glad to know that Dwight's style was on purpose. I wonder what Jim's excuse was. Anyways, now Rain's on board the Office crew, but what about the rest of the team? Ken Kwapis, one of our amazing directors, told us about how another very important saleswoman came to be a part of the show.
Tell me about what's true and what's lore or fairy tale. How did Phyllis get cast in the show?
I will tell you what happened.
Okay.
We were doing kind of more traditional auditions, and in the room, Greg, myself, Phyllis, Allison, and the setup was that I sat next to a video camera, and on the other side of the video camera, Phyllis was sitting, and Phyllis was reading off, and Phyllis was her casting associate.
Yes.
And I hadn't met Phyllis. All I knew is I was sitting next to her, and there was a camera between us, and the actors who were auditioning were, some of them were kind of playing it to the hilt and kind of working a little too hard. Phyllis, meanwhile, was reading her lines in this very kind of monotonal way, sometimes not even looking up at the actors, just looking down at the sheet of paper. And I just became fascinated with her and started looking at her. And there was a couple of actors whose auditions I kind of missed because I kept throwing Phyllis these glances. And I finally, during a break, I took Greg aside and I said, this woman really belongs in a paper company. And so Greg thought about it and he said, sure. And now there is one additional detail that's so wonderful. And that is that after Greg said, sure, let's ask her to be in the bullpen, and she agreed to do it, that Greg and I had a discussion, and Greg said, do you know if she can act? and I took Phyllis aside, and I said, do you have a lot of acting experience? And she said, not really, but she said that some years earlier that she had, worked in burlesque in Branson, Missouri.
Yep.
And I said, stop it. And she then later that week brought in a photo of herself in like a very, wonderfully old-fashioned burlesque outfit.
It was on her desk for 10 years, 9 seasons. Yep.
And so that is the Phyllis story. And
that's amazing.
I couldn't be happier that she became such a beloved member of the ensemble.
So now the crew had come together and The Office was starting to air, but we were still very uncertain about what our future would be. Every day felt like we were on borrowed time. And then lightning struck. Steve landed a massive role. Here's Angela Kenzie to tell us all about it.
40-year-old virgin, right?
40-year-old virgin,
that
yes.
Was the game changer for Steve. And Jenna and I have talked about this, where we had this moment where we're like, oh my God, our friend Steve's going to be like real famous, like real deal famous.
Right.
I really felt like they were banking on Steve. And I was like, okay, I will attach myself to the Steve wagon. I'm banking on him too. I thought that that was a really good sign. But I still wasn't confident. I mean, I still was like, when we finished those first 6, because season 1 was just 6, they printed our names on pieces of paper and then laminated them and put a piece of Velcro on the back. And that's what stuck to your door of your trailer. And I went up to mine and ripped it off and said, I'm going to save that. That was fun.
Because you were sure it was done.
I just didn't know. I mean, they were putting so much at the time. NBC had this show that was like our rival sort of show that was this couple. And they were on every bus everywhere. We weren't on any buses. We weren't anywhere. And I was like, wow, they're putting a lot of money on those guys.
Yes. There was not a whole lot of confidence. But Kevin Riley.
I was about to say, I knew Kevin Riley was fighting for us. And I know that's why when we ultimately won an Emmy, all you guys lifted him in the air. And that's the photo that made the LA Times. Because we all knew as a cast, we stayed on the air because Kevin Riley put his neck on the line for us.
Right. When did you feel like we actually had security?
I know distinctly.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I remember getting an email that our first Christmas episode had become the number one download on iTunes. And I was like, what? And I said, oh, that's it. Mama's getting rid of her Chevy Blazer. And then I got a Honda.
Yeah, that was a huge moment. And it's funny, before that aired, there was a moment that was very significant for you and I, which was Booze Cruise.
Yes.
When we finally became series regulars.
Yep. I found out I was going to be a series regular. And there's a photo that I think Oscar took of Jenna and I when I found out we're jumping up in the air holding hands. And I mean, up until then, we were basically like week to week. Like I remember in Halloween episode when they were like, yeah, we're going to actually fire one person. We were all like, okay, hi, how's it going?
I petition for it to be you. Actually, I want you to know.
I remember saying to my mom, I'm like, Mom, you know, pretty much anyone can go, really. And she was like, well, every office needs a bitch.
That's what she said to you?
Yeah. She's like, every office needs the bitch. I'm like, okay.
So your mom was confident that it wouldn't be you.
My mom was, but you have, you know, Bernie Kinsey.
Yeah.
She's like, don't speak it. Don't speak it. Put out the positive.
Oh, man. So at this time, so this happens. We shoot Booze Cruise. It airs after Christmas. Mm-hmm. Christmas episode happens on TV. Mm-hmm. It's our largest audience ever.
Ever.
Then iTunes streaming, we become number one in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Steve wins the Golden Globes. What do you remember about that night of us at the Golden Globes?
I remember I got a spray tan because I thought I was really white, like too white in my dress. And so people were like, get a spray tan. And then Rain made fun of me so much. He was like, how, what? So one day on The Office, Angela Martin is like pale. And the next day you look like orange. He was like, Angela. I was like, I don't know, Rain. And then we weren't allowed to sit in the main room. Only Steve got invited into the main room where the fancy people were. We were in the annex and we watched him win like on TV.
Right.
And we were, we about like fell out of our chairs. Literally, we fell out of the sofa. We made such a scene that other fancy people were like, who are those guys? We were screaming. We're so excited. And when the party lets out, it lets out into the room we were in. And we like, we tackled Steve. We were so excited.
We were all so excited. It's hard to put into words how special it was for our little show to finally start taking off. And for Steve, our show dad, to start turning into such a massive star. You know, these days, with how popular The Office has become, it almost feels like it's always been that way. But it hasn't. And I think having our own special way of doing things really helped to make that happen. A big part of that was having so many of our writers double as our ensemble cast. So here's Moe's, Mike Schur. When was the decision made for writers to start acting in the show?
From the before the pilot. I mean, Greg, coming from SNL, Greg wanted... SNL is very, the membrane between writers and actors is very thin, and all the actors write stuff, and a lot of the writers are in sketches and stuff, and almost everyone there is a writer-performer, even if he or she is only on staff as a writer or something. And he liked that, and he wanted to get rid of the false dichotomy of writers and actors. So he hired Mindy specifically because she was a performer. She was in a play called Matt and Ben that she had written in New York. He hired BJ because BJ was a stand-up and a writer. And then we made Paul, against his will, play Toby in the first season. Like, we forced, he did not want to do it. He hated it. He hated acting. But we forced him to do it because it was so funny to have him be the guy that Michael Scott hates more than anybody.
Right.
But that was always the design. I think he wanted everybody to write and perform ideally, except for me, because he made me a freak. I most famously and most annoyingly to me played the character Moe Schrute.
Oh my God. We never talked about Moe's. Fuck. Oh my God.
I assumed it was going to be your first question.
No, I have a whole section on it, but you were so great. All right. Well, then just very quickly.
Sure.
You were cast as Moe's.
I was.
And you're happy about that?
No,
are you proud?
I hated it. I hated every second of it.
Why'd you hate it?
Because I was wearing wool clothes and had a neck beard, and it was always really hot. And I didn't. The joke was I didn't talk, and that's not a funny joke. And it was always like I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning and drive to the middle of nowhere and wear wool clothes.
Right.
And it was, and then the joke became with the writers because they knew how much I hated it. They loved, like, what if you're shirtless? What if you're on a seesaw? What if you're on a trampoline? What if you're running as fast as you can alongside a car like a dog? I was at Parks and Rec And they would call me and they'd go like, we need Mo's. And I was like, I have a job. I have a life. I have young children. And they would just make me do it. They would compete with each other to see what was the most humiliating possible thing they could have me do. But that episode, Paul wrote that episode where Jim and Pam go to Shrewd Farms.
Right.
And he wrote in the script, it literally says, Mo's appears out of nowhere and runs along the side of the car like a dog. That's what it says. I'm a human being.
Right.
And so we did that scene. It was 140 degrees. I was in wool clothes and old work boots that like didn't fit properly. And that sprint is probably 150 yards down that dirt road from the time I come out to the time I had to run all the way up into Shrewd Farms. It, of course, cuts off long before I ever get there.
No, of course.
But they were like, Paul was directing, was like, you got to run all the way there. So I did. Over and over and over again. Probably 12 or 14 takes because Paul delighted in it so much. And then later in that episode, I'm in Jurassic Park pajamas that don't fit me properly. And then Greg pitched the thing where he was like, what if there's a loud noise and Pam goes to the window and looks out and Mo's is in the outhouse with his pants down and the door is flapping closed. I mean, it was like, it was aggressive. They knew I never should have admitted, if I had said like, I love doing this, they never would have put me in the show again. But because I hated it so much and was so vocal about hating it.
Well, you have confirmed something. Mo's is a fan favorite. You hear about people loving Mo's.
Great.
Okay. Let me tell you something. What I have always said is, I think Mo's is a writer's room joke.
Oh, and 100%.
You have now confirmed without a doubt.
Yes.
That it was literally a writer's room joke meant to torture you.
Meant specifically to make me miserable, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I was in a coffin. I was like hanging upside down somewhere. Right. Like there were a bunch of things that we did that were then just cut out of the show.
Right.
I was riding a moped over trying to jump a bunch of cars. They made me do that moped thing. I don't know how to drive a moped. Don't know how to drive a moped. No one taught me how to drive. They were like, just get on and just rev the thing. Because the point was, if I wipe out, it'll be really funny.
It'll be really funny.
Yeah, now, and then run across the roofs of these cars. Again, if you slip and fall and break your pelvis, it'll be really funny. Right. Like, the subtext was always, the worse this goes, the funnier it'll be when it happens.
Well, this was after you left. I mean, sort of from the beginning, but then more and more, Kevin started having a lot of physical comedy type stuff.
Sure.
And there would be times where I would go to the writer's room and say, I don't remember if you were ever there, but I would say, you guys are writing for Homer Simpson right now. And a cartoon, you can force to do whatever you'd like him to do. He can do whatever, right? Yeah. But I can't, my body doesn't work that way.
Yeah, no one's does.
Right. Like the most painful, I feel like I still have pain from it, is the most innocuous. You would never, ever, ever know. The office workers have to go to the warehouse and move boxes.
Right.
So they decide they're going to put oil down so they could move boxes to get to the truck.
They try a bunch of different things, yeah.
And everyone thought the big guy falling is really funny. So I just kept falling, slipping. And which means on a concrete surface with oil, kneecap on concrete.
Yeah, man.
Over and it's like, guys, I can't keep, you've got to like... There has to be some other solution.
We had a similar thing on Parks and Rec where Nick Offerman's character, Ron Swanson, was a sort of, he was a little cartoonish in his abilities to do various things. And we wrote this joke where he got lunch and he was eating this hamburger. The joke was he wanted to get out of the lunch as quickly as possible. So in the script, he shoved the entire hamburger into his mouth and ate it in one bite. So Dean Holland was directing it and he was like, okay, action. And Nick did his best. But then Dean was like, you really need to eat the whole thing in one bite. And he was like, this is a half pound hamburger. Okay. Like maybe the character can do this, but a human can't.
A human cannot.
Yeah.
That's like, exactly. Oh, right.
Yeah. Right. Sorry. Yeah. You're not your character. Right. Okay.
Right.
I almost wiped out super hard on that moped. Like, well, first of all, the joke was someone pulls up in the car. It was the garden party episode. Someone pulls up in the car and I'm the valet. Mo's the valet. And I get in and they're like, just get in and tear off down this road, right? And the joke at the time is, why is Mo's driving so fast and so insistent? And so I did. And like, I tore off down the road. And I'm not a stunt driver. I don't know.
Right.
And suddenly I'm going 65 miles an hour on a dirt road and on a set. And the back tire's fishtailed because it's a dirt road.
Right.
And I like... slowed down and was like, oh, right. I'm not, this isn't a, no one's going to like save me if I crash this car.
Right,
I'll die.
Because right.
I also got in and didn't put my seatbelt on because the joke was you get in and take off. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot for a second that I'm not fictional. I'm Mike Shore. I'm not fictional. I'm a human.
I'm a human that could suffer consequences.
Yeah.
Mine, very similar to that, was I think it was when there's the storyline of Dwight telling Holly that Kevin is slow.
Right.
And there was a scene, we did a number of different ways. This didn't end up in, but where I'm driving. And she's like, you're driving. You have a car. And I'm like, yeah, I do. I have a car.
Yeah.
And at one point, they were like, okay, so do that, but then get out of the car, but leave it running. Like, leave
it in gear.
Leave it in gear.
Yeah.
So, like, as you step out, the car's going to move forward, and then we'll have somebody else who can
jump in and stop it.
Yeah. I did it a couple times.
Terrible idea.
It's like profound. Meanwhile, it's Veda's car, right? Like, her real car.
That joke that they did with Kevin in the later years where he didn't know the alphabet.
Elemento.
Paul pitched that in season 2. And we were like, Paul, that's insane. Like, you can't say that he doesn't know he's an accountant. He's a working accountant. Like, he might not be the best accountant.
Right.
But he's an accountant. And it made Paul laugh so hard. And the second that Paul took over the show, that joke aired. And I was like, well, he got what he wanted 6 years later.
Well, at least someone was having fun. But look, we all have a part to play. Am I right? Even if our parts happen to be more dangerous than others. Like Oscar. I don't remember Oscar doing any crazy stunts or being turned into an indestructible office cartoon, right? He had the honor of being the one who always got to keep his composure.
And certainly over in accounting, you were really the straight man. Like, you had your idiosyncrasies.
Yes, I think so.
But in the office, you were the barometer of reason very often.
Jim and myself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is what they're talking about in the coalition of reason.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Are you, if you're looking at sort of the history of comedy in a way,
Oh, come on, you can do it. Brian, I believe in you. Ask your question.
The archetype of the straight man, sort of in the history of comedy. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is that easier for you to do, or is that harder?
Oh, they're both good. It's apples and oranges. It's lovely. It was a lovely character. Because he's a straight man, but he still has a little bit delusions of grandeur, which you need, because that you need that.
Right.
Right? That
well, nobody's perfect or nobody's totally straight.
No.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Angela was a little off too. She was almost there, but then she was a little off. Everybody was a little off, right? Toby, every single, even Jim, he was too much of a prankster. He didn't take the job seriously.
Right.
He was a little too, right?
Right.
Juvenile.
Right. But you know, I think so many of the scenes between you and Steve were so special.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know,
I had to be a straight man in those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You just sit there and stare at him. Just stare at him.
Well, and you would do that.
Well, he said things,
and
yes.
And you would get the laughs.
Yeah.
Because you did that.
Yeah, that's all you had to do, stare at him. And people at home would go, what is he thinking? He can't say anything. It's his job. He's being good. And now he's excusing himself. Thank you. And just get up and leave. Right? Because he's like, Oscar. And it's the buildup, the fucking Carell buildup. Oscar, can I see you for a moment? Sit down. Ask you something. I'm going to go in for a colonoscopy, and what can I do to make it more comfortable for him or me? And he just trails it off and just leaves it. Like it's a solid, like a reasonable question to ask me. And what am I supposed to tell him? I think I just excused myself. I'm like, okay, Mike, I just got up and left.
So we're making The Office, right? And we're starting to get some fans. But then it turns out that some of our fans will actually be joining our motley crew, like the wonderful Ellie Kemper.
Did you watch The Office?
Brian, did I watch The Office? I devoured The Office. I was an enormous Office fan. You don't know what this is like because obviously you were on it from the start, but I loved The Office. I watched it every week. It's very strange to go from watching a television show that you happen to love and then being in the room with everybody. I actually, the first day, of course, felt surreal for many reasons, but it's weird when you, I think maybe anyone has had this experience, if you watch someone on a screen and then you see them in person, it feels otherworldly. And particularly because I already loved everyone on it and admired them so much, it felt even stranger because, yeah, I was a huge fan.
Right.
It was very weird. I really tried to play it cool.
Well, so wait, literally you watched it Thursday night?
Yes. Yes, I did. I lived in New York at the time. And we always, my whole family was a fan of The Office. Have I told you that Moe's, Mike Schur, reminded us of my older brother, John, in college, like when John was in college. So we had like a big joke about that. But yes, no, I lived in New York and I watched The Office every Thursday.
And had you met Allison Jones before?
No. So I met with Greg and Mike, Greg Daniels and Mike Schur. I think I was meeting with them for Parks and Recreation. This was before Parks and Recreation had aired. And I think that's what it was about. I really don't know. It was sort of just a general hello. And after that, I met Allison when I actually read for Parks and Recreation, which it wasn't called Parks and Recreation. It was like Untitled Mike Schur Project. And then I didn't get a part on Parks and Recreation, but then they called me back later for The Office.
Right. And your first day on set, were you nervous?
I was so nervous. I can't remember the actual very first person I met. I remember telling John Krasinski, who I had read was an intern at Conan, and I had been an intern at Conan. Because my first scene, Jim is making a copy at the copy machine, and I'm like sitting there, and I was like in between takes, I was like, you interned at Conan, right? Why did I feel the need to strike up conversation? I am the new person. I think I should stay quiet until spoken to, but I was unusually bold. And he says, oh yeah, you know Conan? And I said, I interned there too. And that was it.
That was it?
I don't know. Somebody walked away. Somebody saved me because I wouldn't have kept that conversation going very well. And then the big news, Brian, I had to dye my hair that day. I have red hair. And as soon as I got there, they were like, you have to dye your hair brown. And I remember Mindy, I saw her in the morning and I saw her in the afternoon and I had brown hair in the afternoon. And she said, why did you let them do that? I would never let anyone dye my hair. I was like, because it's my first job ever. They can do whatever they want. Anyway.
Why did they dye your hair?
Well, I still don't know. I think the reason was they said it looked, that this new character's hair looked too close to Pam's color.
Uh-huh.
But Jenna, but I mean the character Pam. Pam didn't have red hair, did she?
No.
Like, was it chestnutty?
Yeah, I guess. I'm not real good at hair. I'll be honest with you.
Honestly, apparently neither am I. But anyway, yeah. First day memories are sort of blurry because I was so, I don't know. I don't think you can relate to this feeling because, like I said, you were there from the start, but it was just so, it was first day of school, but to the millionth degree because it was like, I'm like in awe of all these people and I'm the new girl. Don't mess anything up.
And of course she didn't. But there was another new girl, well, woman, who came into the Office family a little later on, Amy Ryan. And you, our fans, welcomed her with such open arms. I think maybe that was because she did the one thing no one thought could be done. She completed Michael. But come on, don't we all kind of wish she'd completed Kevin instead? You came in ultimately to be a love interest for Michael, but I have to tell you, the storyline between you and I on the show gets talked about a lot. And yeah. I think in the history of table reads that we had on the show,
it was never more laughs because of the how long that joke
I know
had been used to set up. And you know, when I get asked now about moments in the entire show mm-hmm. where I could not stop laughing, was you and the button. Is literally, if you watch it with the change, this is a nickel. This is a button. And there was something about the sweetness on your face and you just very genuinely explaining to Kevin that this was a button made me smile every single time. And I was like, I can't do it. And they're right there with the camera. I'm like, I can't do it. And basically then just turned it into a grin to say, I'm going to bang you. But that, yeah. Do you think that story could play now?
I mean, there's so much of The Office that I don't know if it could play now. It's interesting. So I just happened to watch that episode because my 10-year-old daughter and all her friends at school are really into The Office. And my daughter is a little behind the rest of her friends because I think it's weird for her.
Yes.
But anyway, so we're watching that episode. And my husband, Eric, and I, like, we're just out of her eye line, but here comes your line, like, I'm totally going to bang her. And I'm like, we look at each other like, and then look over to her face. Does she register that? And, you know, no, because somehow it's going right over their head, I think. Or maybe she doesn't, you know.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I hope a lot of it still plays because I think it's well-intentioned. I don't think we were cruel.
No.
Sadistic people on this show. I mean, but the stuff that doesn't play, it's interesting to think about, as we all think we're like well-intentioned, liberal-minded, caring people, and the stuff that we didn't pay attention to. And so, you know, you're asking me, is it okay to make fun of a person who we think is mentally handicapped? Probably not.
Right.
But it was really funny then. So what do we do with it? Like, you know,
right.
I don't know where that lives.
Right.
I certainly don't want to offend anybody. I mean, I think the joke is upon the person who made the mistake.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, it's,
yes.
How could Holly be that thick-headed or that,
well,
you know.
Well, it's Dwight, really. I mean, it's really that it's Dwight who
well,
is.
Dwight's the naughty
who
one.
Is the naughty
but
one.
But I'm in the middle there of not using my own good judgment or maybe asking for a second opinion or, you know, I mean, we're all judgmental. We say we don't, but we judge everybody that walks down the block, you know.
Right.
In our heads, in the little private tapes in our heads.
Yes. Okay, she's right. Of course we judge people. We try not to, right? I mean, what we try to do is something very different. We try to find truth and beauty in every single part of our lives. And why? Well, that goes back to the captain of our ship, the man we put all our faith in, our showrunner and creator, Greg Daniels.
A few people have talked to me about one of your core ideas, which is the idea of truth and beauty.
Yeah, that was my thing with Randall. I would go, truth and beauty, truth and beauty. Yeah.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, you know, to me, that was, I think that's some romantic poet. I'm not sure where that came from.
Okay.
Somebody like John Keats or something. I don't know. And I don't even know what he meant by it. But the way I used to use it with Randall was, that's what we're going for in the camera, right? Let the camera seek out truth. That's what it's trying to find. That's the point of a documentary. What's the truth? And also not like a cynical negative truth, like, also, where's the beauty? It's like another principle of photography, of like a good photograph is, you know, a little sprig of weed coming through the cracked concrete or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, where are you going to do something that's a little bit inspiring, but find it in a truthful way out in the real world?
Right. Well, Mike Schur talked about it, and you told a story about a parking lot, an endless parking lot with lines and parking spaces. And in one crack, there's a little flower, a little dandelion.
He said that?
Yeah.
That's funny. I just made the same.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that, you know, I like the notion of aesthetic. Like, what are you searching for in art? And the Japanese have interesting aesthetics with a cracked pot. Did he mention that?
No.
I used to use that a lot.
No.
So I think it's called woo. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it's the notion of a perfect pot is okay, you know, and we in the West probably value a perfect pot. But a cracked pot where the crack suddenly makes you feel the history of the pot and the people who've used it in their family and have treasured it and kept it even with the crack in it, like it suddenly cracks through, you know, it suddenly will touch you. It's those little details, often of imperfections. That's like it's just a cool sort of philosophy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have, this so far off topic, but a number of years ago, my parents were moving out of their house and I went for a week and I was like helping them and throwing out all of this trash. And we go into like the corner of the closet in a guest room that no one ever slept in. And in the closet, there was a big piece of paper that was folded up and I unfolded it. And it was a Kennedy poster that my dad had like handed out or seen or collected or whatever. And I remember saying to him, can I have this? And he's like, yeah, it's like all torn or whatever.
Yeah.
And I took it and I framed it and I took it to the display and they were like, oh, we can, you know, do this or that. And I was like, no, the crack has to stay there.
Yeah.
And the wrinkle, the folded marks, just as lightly as you can mat this on something.
Yeah.
And enclose it because I want that history of it. I don't know, that idea.
Yeah. Well, also, like, I mean, you know, I don't get too psychological, but, you know, when you think about your dad, right, the relationship that you have with your father, the fact how old that they are, and just the sense of like passage of time being important to that relationship and fragility of it and knowing that it may not be around forever. And that I can completely see why a tear in your dad's poster
right.
adds to the,
right.
the emotion of it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Totally. Well, there's a lot about writing that isn't necessarily only about the office, but, you know, like when you have a set of principles that you're trying to do for the show, right? If you're going to say, all right, I want to be realistic. I want to be relatable. You know, I want to be observational. If you're going to follow those principles, you're going to end up commenting on what's around you. And this to me goes back a long way. It isn't unique to the show necessarily, but like when I was on The Simpsons, which is, this is, you know, it's a complete cartoon, but the way that one Simpsons writer won respect from another Simpsons writer when I was there was you did something super real. You had a line that just found, like it just came out of a teenager and it was just perfectly, you know, real to the situation. And somehow in contrast to the cartooniness of it, that always seemed to be like a cool thing. And then when I got to King of the Hill, we used to do a lot of research. We would go to Texas. I'd take the writers to Texas every season and we'd fan out with our reporters' notebooks and we'd, you know, we'd try and dig up unique stories because I always felt like the shows that I really liked, the stories were original. Like something had happened to one of the writers or, you know, they weren't just going like, well, what did Cheers do? Let's do a version of that or something. You had to go out and do your own work and dig up your own stories.
Well, Greg, I, for one, am so grateful for the stories you dug up. And I know that I'm not alone. Thank you to everyone who was a part of this episode and to all of you out there listening. Join us next week for another stroll down memory lane with some more of our favorite episodes and guests. In the meantime, all of you have a fantastic week. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our producers are Liz Hayes and Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.